now for your feature presentation.
Just one, or two, or three, or four, but five, of course, five.
What's up, listeners? I am your host, ex-video store clerk, screenwriter, and fellow listener Jason Kleberg, and this is Force 5, a show where I force my guests to come up with a movie-themed top 5 list topic, and then we reveal our picks on air. If you're a gamer or have been a YouTube user for a while, chances are you've seen today's guest, James Rolfe. His YouTube channel, Cinemassacre, boasts nearly 4 million subscribers, and his angry video game nerd character has spawned hundreds of memorable moments and imitators. It's the List Nerd Angry Video Game Nerd crossover you never knew that you needed. Now, James and I both studied film in school, and I'm excited that his topic, 5 Film School Essential Films, allowed us to step back to the head of the class and program a schedule that would set any future filmmaker up for success. If this is your first time listening to Force 5, consider digging through the back catalog a bit after you listen to this one. My guests and topics are extremely diverse, and whether you're a longtime listener or new to the show, take a moment to rate and review Force 5 wherever you get your podcasts. Without further ado, here is James Rolfe and 5 Film School Essential Films. Welcome back to the Force 5 podcast. Today I am joined by James Rolfe, a director, actor, writer, and producer who is undoubtedly best known as his character, The Nerd, his insanely popular YouTube series, The Angry Video Game Nerd. James, welcome to Force 5. How are you today?
Hey, very good. Thanks for having me.
I'm sure you hear this all the time whenever you're interviewed or on somebody else's show, but I really admire your work. I remember discovering your show. I was traveling for work a lot. It must have been like 2011 or so. And I had nothing to do when I got to a new city, but hang out in my hotel room and watch YouTube on my laptop. And I remember watching your episode on the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles on Nintendo and thinking, this guy gets exactly how I felt when I was 8 years old, trying to navigate through those fucking underwater seaweed things. Oh my gosh. And, you were one of the pioneers of YouTube. And I think it's pretty amazing that you're still doing this series 20 years later.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. The time flies. That's a lot of episodes.
Yeah. What are you up to now in terms of episodes? I mean, you're dozens of seasons in now.
Yeah, I'm working on a bunch of stuff. The Nerd is the main series on the channel, but I also do movie reviews and different topics like that. I'm working on my first fiction book right now and also working on a music album. So there's a lot of things going on. So in between all the regular web videos, I'm working on these longer passion projects, the type of things that take longer until they're, you know, complete.
That's amazing. You're a very busy man, for sure, with all the series that you have and all the other stuff going on. Now, one of the inevitable aspects of being a pioneer in the online space is that you're going to have clones and imitators popping up, and you kind of spawned a subgenre of reviewer, the angry blank. Out of all the people that have like aped your style and what you were doing, do you have one that you thought, hey, that's actually pretty good? Or do you just choose not to watch those who ripped off your format?
Oh, yeah. No, lots of times. I really enjoy seeing them. I don't usually get time to watch them because I'm usually too busy working on my own stuff. But it is cool to watch others and just see, how they take it, like what kind of direction they go with.
And there are hundreds, probably thousands of imitators now.
Yeah, there's too many to keep up with. Yeah, far too many to keep up with.
Well, your subscribers know this, but casual viewers might not. You're much more into movies than you are video games, and that's what we're here to talk about. So I guess one last gaming slash movie question to transition us. What is your favorite video game based on a film? You've obviously covered a ton that are terrible, but what's your favorite video game that's based on a film?
Yeah, I've been thinking about that. I really don't know. I'm not sure what my favorite is because I'm thinking of saying Alien Isolation, even though I have gotten very far in the game at all. I like what they've done with it because it feels just like the movie. And I think that's what you want when there's a video game movie, especially something that's meant to be really scary like that. It's meant to feel like it just puts you in the film. Although that doesn't mean I'm very good at the game. I have a lot more to... I just wander around the same areas over and over and over again. I suck at that game. I've never encountered the alien yet. and I'm still waiting to get there. But I like what they've done with it. I like the graphics and the sound, and it's very immersive.
I guess that's a testament to how good the game is when it's one of your favorites, but you haven't even seen the alien yet.
Yeah, that's why I didn't even want to say it's my favorite, but I think it might become my favorite if I can get anywhere in it.
It's a good one. It's a really fun game. Yeah. Now, talking movies, when I reached out, I thought for sure that you were going to do something monster movie related or that you were going to pitch Hammer Horror. Mm-hmm. But as is the case with many of my guests, you came with a topic that I was not expecting. Five films that are essential for a film history class, which is a great topic because you can literally go anywhere with this. Mm-hmm. And I've got many reasons why I chose the films I did. But before we get into that, what was your experience in film school like at UArts in Philly?
Oh, it was a lot of like finding your identity. I think that was really what the professors seemed to be, you know, trying to help with. Like, even if they showed a lot of like really pretentious art films, but I think even those were helpful because you'd take something from them.
Sure.
Because they would show you things that they know you're never going to watch on your own time. And they're meant to get a reaction from you one way or another. Like, even if you hate it, then that will create some kind of counter art in your head. So then you'll try to do something that's different than that. It reinforces what you really do want to do. So I think art school, for me, it was all about just finding your style, finding your craft. The technical side was more learned by the students because we all kind of taught each other that thing. There were two distinct generations. The teachers were more old school, like shoot on film and edit on film. We actually spliced film.
Oh, nice.
And students were more about like, well, you know, let's look into these computers. You know, I hear that you could edit on computers and it's a lot easier. So we had to teach each other that. We were just a younger generation, I guess, that was pioneering that sort of thing.
Sure. Did you have any classes with Justin Guarini?
No, I don't remember.
Random question, but that dude was at your school around the same time.
Was he?
Yeah.
What major?
That's a good question, but I'm guessing it's something music related.
Yeah, it was very isolated where like film majors were with the film majors and then, you know, dance majors were with the dance majors and music was like a totally different building.
Sure.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Well, you've made over 270 films in your life, including the feature length theatrically released Angry Video Game Nerd, the movie. Mm-hmm. What are some of the films that inspired you along the way? Like what are some of your favorite movies of all time?
Oh, yeah. Well, it'll probably cross over with this list.
All right. Well, don't mention any of the ones that are going to show up on your list.
Yeah. So I think that my number one film, which actually doesn't show up on the list, is it's a mad world.
Nice.
And I kind of like that it's sort of an oddball film that, I mean, it has a following, but it's a little more of a cult following. It's not Back to the Future or Ghostbusters or something. It's a Mad World is a all-star comedy film from the 60s. So anybody who was famous in comedy was in that film pretty much. But it's also an adventure movie. It's a treasure hunt. And it's a very long movie because it's meant to take place in real time. There's actually no cross dissolves until the end where these characters go on this trip through Southern California and you actually sort of experience it in real time as they go through, or at least it's meant to feel like it's real time. There's different, the movie has been cut into different versions. The original version was very long. It was over 3 hours. I just love the scenery in it. I love that it makes me think of Southern California and it's very colorful. There's tons of characters in it and with so many characters and so many people to keep track of, that can be a hard thing to do, but every performance just stands out where like they tell you everything you need to know about the character in a very short time. You kind of just get them. You're like, oh, I get this person. That's their deal. And the way they all come together is very funny. So it's my favorite film.
It's got a great jokes per minute ratio. Like it's a really funny movie. And listeners, if you haven't seen this movie, you got to go out and get it. I'm pretty sure it's on the Criterion Collection too. So it's got a really good disc.
Yeah, they have a restored version where they restored as much as possible to the original length that showed at the Cinerama Dome during the premiere, but I actually do recommend the shorter one. If you haven't seen it yet, I would say, because the shorter one is still 2 hours, 45 minutes. That's still quite a, you know, long movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't think you're losing too much of it. So I'd say start with that one.
All right, there you go. Well, it seems like a perfect time to get into our topic today. James, are you ready to get into our lists?
Yeah.
You know what's going to happen? You know what's happening right now? You know what's going to happen?
No.
Words? You just made the list.
Five essential films for a film history class. What was your thought process programming these five films?
Well, the thought process, because that's, yeah, it's something very much worth discussing is like, why would you pick these? So I was going through some old film notebooks that I had from film class, and I found one from one of my early, early film class, like before college. This was a Saturday course, a summer course, this one. And I found in my notebook a list of films that I wrote down that the professor said, you need to go see these. These were ones we didn't watch in class. These were ones he was just recommending, like, oh, you got to see these movies. And actually, I'd like to read the list to you here.
Yeah.
So he wrote, he had us write Battleship Potemkin, which we've seen a ton of times in film class, Alexander Nevsky, 8½, Persona, Wild Strawberries, Seven Samurai, Lawrence of Arabia, and House of Games, which was the oddball choice on there, which great movie though. But House of Games was actually more in line with, I think, what the professor actually liked, because he was more, the type of films he made were nothing like these. I think because that's a distinction right there, is like, you're not necessarily telling somebody your favorite films. You're telling them films they think you should see. And what's funny too, I haven't completed that list until just, recently. So it took me like 25 years or something, but I finally finished his list. But that got me thinking. I was like, well, if I were in that situation, if I were the teacher in that class, what would the films be that I would say you'd have to see?
Sure.
And it gets a little complicated, because would you recommend Star Wars? The assumption is everybody's probably seen that. But for the purpose of this list, I think you should go with just thinking that nobody has seen a film. Like, if you've never seen a single movie, regardless of how common it is to just recommend it as like, okay, make sure you've seen this. This is a mandatory film. Now, with that said, Star Wars is not on my five, because we're only picking five here. If we were to pick 10 or maybe actually probably more like 20, Star Wars might be on there. But you know how this is. You could go through like hundreds of movies that are mandatory that you got to see. But if it's just going to be five, and you're in that classroom where that teacher was, like, if you go back in time, sort of like a quantum leap, like if you were to go into that teacher's body right there and just say, here's the films you should see, what would you say?
All right, that's a good way to narrow it down. What was the last film on his list that you needed to cross off before you got through them all?
The last one that I saw, and I had mixed feelings about all these, it was actually Alexander Nevsky. Mm. That was the last one. It was by Sergio Eisenstein, who did Battleship Potemkin. Battleship Potemkin, I always thought, was overrated. They showed it a lot, and usually for the editing. The Odessa step sequence is like that sequence where you break it down, you pause it every frame, and you analyze that sequence. But there's a lot of movies from that time period, I think, that have really good editing.
Yeah.
And like, I don't know why they don't talk about Metropolis more. That is what it is. It's just a famous movie that I think at one point was considered the greatest film of all time. Even though I don't get, there's so many great films from the silent era, but yeah, then I think that film got overtaken by the number one as time went on. But anyway, we'll get into all that.
Indeed. So I approach this from a lens of, if I had five films to show a class full of prospective directors, mm-hmm. what would be the most important films to show them? And then I put it in the order that I would show them. So these aren't in the order of my favorite films on this list, but it's mm-hmm. in the order that I would show it to them. And that being said, I think that my number one is really going to surprise people, but I have a really good reason why it's here. So I'll just preface with that.
Yeah. The craft is important too. Just like, what techniques does this movie use? What it, just, it has to demonstrate, like, what movies can do.
Exactly.
What is this medium for?
Do you think we'll have any crossover picks? Like, do you think we'll share any of the same picks?
I hope we don't. I hope that they're all so different, because then you get 10, you know?
Yeah.
But anyway, we'll see.
I could see one popping up on both lists.
Okay.
All right, James, let's get into it here. Do you want to start off, or do you want me to kick things off here?
Oh, you can kick it off.
All right. So number five on my list, I'm going to start with the most obvious pick, with good reason. I'm going to go with Citizen Kane from 1941.
When people ask me what my favorite film is, I usually say Citizen Kane, because that doesn't surprise anyone, and it seems like a reasonable choice. I could easily have put down, for example, The Third Man, or La Dolce Vita, or Notorious, or Singing in the Rain, or 2001, but Citizen Kane is a real good choice, because this is one, not only the most famous movies ever made, but certainly one of the most entertaining. This was the first film made by Orson Welles. It was the film in which he was given complete control of all of the tools of filmmaking. This young man from New York who made a name for himself on the stage and on radio, and went to Hollywood to conquer the movie industry, and certainly did so with his first film. This is a movie that's told in a whole series of interlocking flashbacks as various people who remember Kane or who knew Kane respond to an inquiring reporter who wants to know the meaning of Kane's final deathbed word.
Find out about Rosebud.
I didn't see this movie until about 4 years ago, and I didn't love the movie after watching it. I'd obviously heard about it for a million years. After watching it, you do realize how important it was in terms of what it introduced to filmmaking. And before I get into those things that this film popularized, I want to say I know that these techniques weren't invented by Orson Welles and his cinematographer, Greg Tolan, but it was certainly the film that everybody saw and latched onto and were influenced by. The first and probably most obvious for any film school student, anybody who's been to film school like you, I'm sure they talked about Orson Welles and his use of deep focus, which allowed everything in the screen to be in focus, which was achieved with a very small aperture. But before this, most films had characters in the foreground and then you'd have characters in the background. But in order to show them, you either had to cut away or you had, you know, the background person out of focus and the person in the foreground in the focus. And then they would swap based on what they wanted to have the audience focus on. But now they're doing everything in focus. And it was, for those folks in 1941, it was like watching a painting, but a moving painting. And it was really, really interesting and innovative at the time. They also did an amazing use of tracking shots, which, again, had been done before, but never like this. You had cameras floating through signs. You had cameras floating through panes of glass. If you've ever seen a David Fincher film, you can tell he was clearly inspired by what Orson Welles was doing. It's visual storytelling at its finest. No shot seems unnecessary. Everything is done with a purpose to move the story forward. You've got low angle shots to show somebody larger than life. The use of lights and shadows. There's just so much here that any film student can learn from. And it's funny, Orson Welles was asked on a talk show once how he knew he could do this, because he made this film at 26 years old. And the guy interviewing him said, "How did you know that you could do this when nobody before you could figure it out?" And I love his answer. He said, "Well, you know, sheer dumbness. It's ignorance, and there's no authority in the world like it." He was just like, "It can probably be done." And again, this is not one of my favorite movies, but I know that it's still studied in schools today, 80 plus years later, paid homage to in just about everything, and parodied a million times over. And there's a great reason for that. So yeah, my number five is my most obvious choice here, Citizen Kane from 1941.
And we did it already. Number five, Citizen Kane.
Awesome.
So we picked the same one as number five. Now, I mean, where it fits in, I find harder. It's like, okay, should it be five? Should it be four? Should it be two? You know, but So going with Citizen Kane still. At the time when I was in film school, I just wanted to get away from that movie because every professor showed it. Like, we watched it multiple times. And but this list is assuming that you hadn't seen it. So if you haven't seen Citizen Kane, you definitely should.
Yeah.
And it is very relevant today. And it gets better with time. I think seeing it more mature definitely helped. there were two things in that movie I couldn't really get over when I was younger. I'm like, yeah, I like the techniques and everything. I think that's all cool. But the first thing that I didn't like about it was just the character. I was like, well, this guy is an asshole. And then I realized, well, he's supposed to be like, you're not really supposed to like this guy, but that's where it's complicated because as a kid, he's pretty innocent and he has like this abusive father and you sympathize with him when he's younger. But then as he sort of like rises to power, he just becomes more and more like a scumbag. And that's really interesting in itself. I mean, how many movies can you think of back then where like the main like protagonist of the film is somebody who is very flawed and you don't really know what to think of him. And the other thing I didn't really like when I was younger was that there was so much about the newspapers. And I just thought that was outdated. It's like, well, you know, nobody is really into newspapers the way they were back then. It's very antiquated. But I don't think that's true anymore. I think that the newspapers, it's just as you just switch it out for social media. That's all. Like if they were to remake Citizen Kane, it would be social media. And the idea of the newspaper is just that it's like it's power, like him writing those headlines, like he's controlling the narrative. He wants his voice to be the story that you hear. So that's really what the newspaper is. It's sort of his tool for, you know, spreading his word and controlling the narrative. So I think all that stuff is just really fascinating. Yeah, I mean, it's a really great movie.
All right, so that's both of our number fives. We've crossed over here. I don't know that we'll cross over the rest of this list because they're a little unconventional, but we will see. All right, at number four. So I've taught these students about camera work and technique, and now we're going to start getting into some storytelling along with that technique. Everybody is going to have a different opinion about the scariest film ever made. But in my opinion, it is Silence of the Lambs. Mm. And the reason that I put this on my list is twofold. One, it shows what a director can get out of amazing actors. Mm-hmm. And two, it shows you how you can make something insanely suspenseful, even though there are no jump scares. And mm-hmm. when you rewatch the movie, really not that much violence. In my opinion, this film is a masterpiece, and I'm going to show my students why.
A rookie FBI agent, intelligent and determined. A brilliant psychiatrist, manipulative and insane.
What does he do, this man you seek?
A series of brutal crimes only he can help her solve.
Are you saying that he's killed again?
A series of questions only she dare ask.
Tell me his name, doctor.
All good things to those who wait.
The Silence of the Lambs.
Yes!
Rated R. Started Thursday, February 14th at theaters everywhere.
First up, Jodie Foster. I mean, her acting work as a young FBI recruit, Clarice Starling, is amazing. She won the Oscar that year, rightfully so. But her performance is also helped by great direction and camera work. So one of the themes for Clarice is seeing men as predators. And this is shown in the way that scenes are blocked. You often see her surrounded by groups of men, many of whom are continuously staring at her. There's a great scene in an elevator where all the guys, the other recruits, are wearing red, and she's kind of small right in the middle of them wearing gray, and everyone in the elevator is just kind of looking down at her. And then, of course, Anthony Hopkins, who isn't in this film very much, but it's really what most people remember about this movie. He's mesmerizing as Dr. Hannibal Lecter, and he also won an Oscar for his role in this, but he's helped by camera angles. So, for example, Clarice, who is coming in brand new to the FBI, and she meets Hannibal for the first time, he's staring directly into the camera, putting you into the shoes of the character, and it's uncomfortable. And he does that a lot. Jonathan Demme, the director, he does that a lot with the males in this movie. When she's not feeling confident, they stare directly into the camera. And then one other thing that I have always thought was amazing about this movie is the first time that Clarice meets Hannibal Lecter. She goes into this really dingy underground cell area. It's really dark, really dimly lit. And she walks past a couple of cells, and it's like the prisoners get more psychotic as she goes along. It's like levels. So you get the first guy, and he's kind of like smirking. And then the second guy really looks deranged. The third guy is really wild. And then the fourth one, of course, is Hannibal Lecter. And the image in your mind as the viewer is already built up to this because you've heard so many characters talk about how psychotic he is. And I've always loved that camera technique here. So this would be kind of a way to continue the visual storytelling techniques, along with showing them how casting the right people in the right roles can make all the difference from a fine film to a really iconic movie. There's a reason that this is, it's mostly a police procedural, but it's remembered as one of the scariest, best movies of all time. And it's one of the rare horror movies to win a Best Picture nomination. So yeah, Silence of the Lambs is what I got it for.
Yeah, it'd be a very different movie without Anthony Hopkins in there. And it's also interesting how, you know, Hannibal is the one you always think of, but the real villain is Buffalo Bill. And Hannibal is kind of like the one who does all the speaking for Bill. Like he's kind of like the voice of the villain. And you get that trope a lot in other movies too. Like, I don't know, like, I mean, off the top of my head, Jaws, like you have Quint talking about the shark. It's like, got the blackest eyes. And, you know, the shark doesn't do any speaking. You hardly even see the shark. I mean, it's just a, you know, it's just a shark. But Quint is like the one, you know, delivering all the good, like juicy lines. So I think like that's Hannibal's role in that movie is like, you know, it's just, it's so good the way it's done. I think I'm going to go Vertigo for number four.
Even though the film was not received well at the time, we responded to the film very strongly. Didn't know why. Couldn't really tell why. Couldn't tell what was happening. But we really went with the picture and remembered it. And it took years for us to see it again. But there's a sequence in that film where he's just following, Jimmy Stewart's following Kim Novak in her car. And it's just shot after shot of him driving. It's how he's composed in the center of the frame, how she's composed. It's the serenity of the camera positions. I'm not saying that just to be a contraire, you know, to some of the murder scenes in Psycho and that sort of thing. Yeah, I like watching those. The actual shower scene in Psycho I use as a template for some of the for one of the big moments in Raging Bull for a fight scene as a template. But I'm finding that over the years, the scenes that stay with me are the seemingly quieter scenes, the scenes where it appears that not much is happening with the Hitchcock film. And it's all happening there in him, the obsession of following her everywhere she goes with that car.
It's a movie that, it's really two films put together. Like it starts off like a film noir, like a simple detective story. And I'm kind of, I don't want to explain too much of it for anybody who hasn't seen it, because I feel like I would just ruin it. But the second half of it is really where it gets more psychological. How do I say it? It's a movie about nostalgia and like being sentimental over something that, you know, there's a loss that you can't get back. And it really taps into that. And that's one of my favorite themes in stories, I think. Something that I repeat a lot in my own work. But I think as a film class, it's really great just from like a structure standpoint, just to see like how there is a very major event that happens in the middle of the movie that changes the course of the entire plot after that. And also how like there's several ways in which it could resolve itself. And you're not really sure which way it's going to go. And there's the movie leaves several outcomes. It's not as simple as like, you know, like there's a good guy and a bad guy, or somebody's trying to find something or get to some place. It's just all over. And you don't know what's going to happen. That there's a lot of, it's very ambiguous how everything wraps up in that third act. So I think from that point of view is why I would show it to a film class.
I'm so glad that you put Hitchcock on here. I wrestled with a couple of Hitchcock movies before I decided on Silence of the Lambs, actually, because I'm like, you know what? I got to get a suspense movie on here. But I was wrestling between Psycho and Strangers on a Train. To have Vertigo on here is perfect, though. I think that's a great choice.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
All right. Number three here. You can't have a great movie without a great screenplay. Obviously, a great story, a great script can turn something from what could be a good movie into an iconic film that stands the test of time. And I've talked about this movie at length on this show and others. It is Die Hard. And I'm going to throw it out there. I think Die Hard is one of the best scripts ever written. And there's a reason that it spawns imitators even today.
They have already killed one hostage.
This channel is reserved for emergency calls only.
Do I sound like I'm ordering a pizza?
High above LA, a team of terrorists have seized the building.
Oh!
They're ready for anything. Except a New York cop trapped inside.
Come on to the coast. We'll get together. Have a few laughs.
Bruce Willis, Die Hard.
But all things being equal, I'd rather be in Philadelphia.
Rated R. Now playing in selected cities. Starts Wednesday, July 20th at theaters everywhere.
This script is so tight. Everything that happens makes sense. Everything that is set up is paid off. It's a film that, by all accounts, almost never got made. It was stuck in development hell for a long time. It was originally intended for Frank Sinatra, starring in a movie based on a book called Nothing Lasts Forever. And then it was expected to fail once it was getting made because it had an unproven TV comedic actor in the lead role, Bruce Willis, who most people know as an action star, you know, through the 90s and the 2000s. But at this point, he was doing moonlighting on TV and he looked nothing like the action stars of the 80s. He looked nothing like an Arnold or a Stallone. There are so many reasons why this could have failed, but there are also so many reasons why this is watched every season by me. I'm sure thousands of others. It's about the script, setups, payoffs. It does a great job of raising the stakes, which is, to me, is one of the most important things in an action movie. At the end of the first act, John McClane is well-armed. He's got a bag of C4. And you think, all right, this guy's ready to become a one-man army. And then soon he finds himself down to one gun and two bullets. Eventually, shoot the glass. He's running around with his feet all cut up. He's got no help from the outside world. And it does a great job of kind of pushing things to another level every couple of minutes. It's also got one thing that I think movies today can learn a lot from, and that's unforced moments of levity that do not feel tacked on. It's one of the complaints I have with Marvel movies. You can have a really great scene, a really powerful emotional scene, and then somebody cracks a joke. But it feels like, all right, the writers just thought, we need a joke in here. Let's force something in. But in Die Hard, it just feels like John McClane's personality. He's a flawed guy who's trying to get through the day. You know that he probably talks like this every single day. It's not just him doing it for the cameras.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the last piece that I really appreciate about Die Hard is every script is going to have exposition. But Die Hard does it in really, really smart ways. It never feels forced when we're getting information about the situation. It always feels natural. And I think script, screenplays, Die Hard it's my favorite script. And I would love to show it to a film class because you probably have a lot of people that just think, oh, this is an action movie or this is, you know, a dumb Bruce Willis vehicle, but it is so much more than that.
Yeah. Well, there were a lot of dumb action vehicles that copied Die Hard. And then there's also yeah. like a lot of good movies too that copied Die Hard as well, like Speed with Keanu Reeves. Yeah. Like, yeah, I mean it's kind of a Die Hard sort of plot. You know, it's like it either involves hostages or somebody like you know in a situation like that. But yeah, I mean, I just think how many movies to this day are basically doing what Die Hard did in some sense.
Yep, Die Hard on a blank. There's a whole podcast called Die Hard on a Blank.
Is there? That's awesome.
Hey, listeners, jumping in here to talk about one of our sponsors today, Elmdale Escape. If you've never been to an escape room, now is your chance. Try out their beginner's room with the laboratory. Ready to play guinea pig in a science experiment gone wrong? Mix chemicals, dodge explosions, and avoid the mad scientist who's just one failed experiment away from a meltdown. And if you can make it out of there alive, try the brand new Darwin-themed Galapagos room. Think you can handle island life? Outwit giant tortoises and navigate through puzzles trickier than juggling jellyfish to rescue Charles Darwin, who's being held captive by his arch nemesis, rival scientist Dr. Alfred R. Wallace. Pro tip, parrots can't really talk, but they sure can mock your failed attempts at escaping. So why choose Elmdale Escape? Well, number one, it's perfect for friends and family because being trapped in a room together builds character and reveals who cracks under pressure. It's also great for team building and ideal for coworkers who need to learn that sometimes sending out an SOS is better than another goddamn Microsoft Teams meeting. And finally, it's fun. If you escape, you'll feel like a genius. And if you don't, at least you'll have a funny story about how Steve from accounting can't solve a toddler-level puzzle. Book now at Elmdale Escape, where getting locked in means unlocking the hilarity. If you think you've got what it takes, or at least can pretend convincingly, join us for an experience that's one part brain workout, two parts comedy. It's located just west of Goodwood, in between the Rosebud Motel and Herb Ertlinger Winery. As is tradition, that was a fake ad, but F5 does have a real sponsor this week with Hiya Health. Hiya is a vitamin company made for kids, getting them essential super nutrients that they need to be their best. I've said it before on this show, my kid, picky eater, and now they've just added an iron-rich vitamin, so if your kid is like mine and rarely eats anything with iron in it naturally, this is a good way to sneak it back into their diet. Hiya vitamins are delivered straight to your door. No sugars, no dyes, no gummy additives. Head to HiyaHealth.com and use my code in the show notes to receive 20% off your first order. And I should stress, this is a real ad. If you've got kids, give these a shot and get some money off by using my code. All right, listeners, back to the show. All right, number three for you.
Number three for me is 2001, Space Odyssey.
First time on television, Stanley Kubrick's mind-blowing epic journey, 2001, A Space Odyssey. Now an NBC big event. Astounding entertainment starring Keir DeLay and Gary Lockwood. 2001, A Space Odyssey. Tonight at 8, 7 Central Time on the NBC big event.
I was figuring Kubrick would make it onto the list somewhere.
Oh, yeah, I guess it had to, yeah. I mean, it's tough. It's really tough to pick just five. But so 2001 is a movie where it could only exist as a film. Now, there was a book made at the same time, and the book is awesome too, but the book is a book and the movie is a movie. And what I would actually recommend the class is to experience both. Read the book, watch the movie, and see how they're related, but they're also just like worlds apart. The book communicates in, like, you know, a literary language. It and the way it communicates ideas to you is through the written word. But 2001, the movie, it's purely a visual experience. It communicates in a language that is native to film. It's also a very unconventional kind of movie because it's not really like you don't have like a really simple plot structure to follow. There's not like dialogue explaining everything. It's like it's just gonna show you the visuals and just take you on this experience from the dawn of humanity all the way till like the future of humanity. Like, you know, how much more epic can you get than that?
I watched this movie when I was way too young. I had a substitute teacher in like fifth grade that wheeled one of those big TVs into the classroom to put this on VHS. I have no idea why. I must have been 11 or 12. I had no idea what I was seeing. Well, that's a good segue into my number two here, because I'm also going to assign a book with this one.
Okay.
By this time in the class, I've gone through techniques regarding camera work, acting, visual storytelling, a great script. So it's time to get into filmmaking itself. Movie making is hard work, but it doesn't have to cost a lot. And that's why I am tossing out El Mariachi from 1992 here, the Robert Rodriguez film.
Yeah.
You know, people ask me, El Mariachi, did you really make that for $7,000? How did you do that? And it's just so hard to sit there and try and explain it. It's much easier to show raw footage from the movie, scenes, what they looked like before they were edited. So you can see exactly how to put a movie together very inexpensively by yourself if need be. First of all, I shot this movie silent. What that allowed me to do actually was save a lot of film, because I didn't have any film slates. I didn't have any sync slates. In fact, the only indication we had to put on the roll at all was at the head of it to show what roll we were on. And this is roll 15. You can see I just had the actors hold their fingers up. After that, there's no slates.
He made this movie for $7,000. I know that you have made movies since you were a lot younger.
Yeah, yeah.
How much did your first films cost you?
My first film, well, nothing really, but
exactly.
You're talking about, like, you know, the old days, like on VHS and everything.
Yeah, I mean, just, you know, stuff you were making with your friends and family.
Yeah, I mean, usually nothing, but But yeah, El Mariachi, that was actually like the movie that inspired me really to make movies. The book, Rebel Without a Crew. It's like
that's the book. Yep.
Great. Yeah. But I remember like in film class, a lot of times I would like, that's the reason I was there. You bring that up in film school, or at least in my film school, and they'd be like, that movie didn't cost $7,000. There's no way, which they mean is the post, all the posts that happened that the studios put into it afterwards, like including the marketing and everything. It was a lot more than that.
Yeah.
But the movie that he made was $7,000. And then that got the studios to put the rest of the money into do everything that they did. But yeah, I thought that was super inspiring too, because it wasn't even like a really, it wasn't like an art house movie. It was more like trying to make an action film, but on a shoestring budget.
My first festival submission, I think, cost us around $200. And that was including the entry fee, which was probably $100 of it.
Oh, yeah.
And of course, before that, you know, I just like you, I was making movies on VHS-C cameras and cutting them with two VCRs and stuff like that. You know, with the technology people have in their pockets today, you can make something extremely awesome for almost no money. We have filmmakers right now making movies with iPhones, and they're in theaters. So I would want to highlight one of the more famous examples of somebody making a movie on the cheap here. And I would also assign his book, Rebel Without a Crew, as required reading. Like you were saying, $7,000. Obviously, the advertising for the movie showed that. It was like, this is the movie made for $7,000. But his technique, Robert Rodriguez, his technique was really, really simple. Save as much money as you can during every scene. So that included making his own props, borrowing props. He borrowed actual guns from police officers to load the blanks into. Not recommended today, by the way. Yeah. using actors as crew members instead of having them just stand around like you would typically see on a film set. He had an actor who was a bad guy in one scene, and he was like the dolly operator in another scene. Luckily, Robert Rodriguez is not, he's not one to keep this close to the chest. He's very open about how his experiences, how he shot, how he edited the movie. If you pick up the DVD release of any of these films, he has something called 10 Minute Film School on there where he talks about some of his techniques that are really, really cool. But my theme here with El Mariachi is creativity and really just seeing what comes out of a brilliant mind when you don't see limitations. You're just thinking, how can I get this done for as cheap as possible? I think that would be a great spot before my number one here with El Mariachi.
Yeah. And the camera you mentioned, one thing I remember that I really liked was how he doesn't use tripods a lot. He likes to hold the camera, and if he's going to hold it and it's going to shake a little, why not move it? So he's always moving the camera around. And if they do a take and the take's no good, why shoot the second take from the same angle? He moves. And then in case you want to still use something from that first angle, now you just have more angles. Which isn't usually an easy thing to do, because usually on a film set, you have the camera like locked down on a tripod and there's like all kinds of stuff in the way. You got lights. To move a shot isn't as easy as it seems. But he goes handheld and he gets in close and he does all the stuff because he's holding the camera all the time. So he can always get, even if it's like one step to the right, he's got something different this way. So
yeah,
really good film school movie.
Dude's amazing. All right, two for you, James. We're almost done here.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, because this is like mandatory films, I'm going to say Wizard of Oz, because it's like the first movie to use color in that way.
Many, many miles east of nowhere lies the amazing land of Oz, a magnificent empire created in the mind of a man who wrote a great book about it. Like wildfire in the wheat field, the fabulous tale of the Wizard of Oz spread from town to city to nation to the entire world. Although the Wizard of Oz has captivated the children of four generations and fired the imaginations of those youthful adults who have never grown old, although 10 million copies of the book have reached eager hands and eager hearts, no one has dared the towering task of giving life and reality to the Land of Oz and its people. Every delightful character of L. Frank Baum's classic is now reborn. Every glorious adventure has been recaptured and painted with a rainbow. The celebration in Munchkinland.
Again, if you read the book of Wizard of Oz, it doesn't have the ruby slippers. They're gray. But the movie made the slippers red. It made Dorothy's clothing blue, the yellow brick road, the green witch. Like, I don't even think there was a green witch before that. Like, that might have even, that possibly might have established the trope of the green witch. You know, the Emerald City, like, there's just so much color in that movie. And that they use color as part of the story, like, where, you know, the beginning is in sepia tone because it's meant to be like boring. Like, she's living in her usual boring life, and then she goes on this like adventure, and then that's when the color all opens up. And I like the fact that the characters all have very well defined goals. Like, you know, she wants to go home. The lion wants courage. The scarecrow wants a brain. The Tin Man wants a heart. It's like they all have these very just easy goals in mind, and they have a very simple place they need to go to get there. It's like, well, here's the road. There's the Emerald City. The wizard is in there. We got to go to him. It's just very simply done. And I mean, it has a great twist at the end. And there's just, you know, so much fundamental storytelling aspects going on there. So that's my number two.
I would have been shocked if this wasn't on your list. I know that this is one of your favorite movies of all time.
Yeah, yeah.
With good reason. Okay, number one here, grand finale for me. Unconventional pick coming up, but I think it's necessary. I'll explain why after your shock of why I picked this.
Okay.
But also, there's going to be some homework that my students are going to have to do with this one, because not only do I have a film here, I have a TV series to go along with it, and I'd require them to read the script to this movie as well. My number one pick here is a movie from 2002 called Stolen Summer.
Hmm.
Have you ever heard of this movie?
No, I haven't actually. Seems like I will have to watch this then.
Well, yeah, let me get through the explanation first and we'll see. We'll see. So this movie is the result of a reality TV series executive produced by Miramax, Ben Affleck, and Matt Damon in 2001 called Project Greenlight. Do you remember that show, Project Greenlight?
Yes, I do remember that. Yeah.
Yeah, so it basically was an early HBO reality show that started as a screenplay contest. And at the time, it was the largest screenplay contest ever. And the goal was simple, to give the winner a chance to direct their script for $1 million.
Tell us what is Project Greenlight?
It starts off as an internet contest.
You submit a screenplay over the internet.
Submit your screenplay electronically.
We really wanted to do something to sort of give people a chance. We think there's a lot of smart, good, talented people out there that it's just really hard to break in.
You have just as good a chance as anyone else. You don't have to know anybody. You don't have to be anybody's brother. It's completely on the merits of your work.
It's also something that we wish was around when we were trying to sell our screenplay.
When we started on Goodwill, we were three guys trying to break in. And
we felt like you had to have like some, you know, the secret keys to the kingdom.
The contest was designed to be a peer review contest. People registered online, put up their screenplays, had to read three screenplays, and all the screenplays got reviewed
by the other contestants.
The winner gets $1 million to make their movie.
So it's $1 million budget?
It's $1 million budget for the film.
Since we're not doing the Survivor thing.
Right. It's $1 million to make the movie, and Miramax has guaranteed the $1 million, has guaranteed to distribute the movie. So basically, Miramax is greenlighting a movie. They just don't know which movie yet. They're going to go through the entire process until there's one left.
The first few episodes of the show are about the contest itself. First, they narrow it down to like 30 people, and then they have those 30 people. They like mailed in tapes of themselves saying why they should win. And then they weeded that down to 10 people, 10 scripts. And they sent a box of equipment to all 10 people with the mission of you need to shoot a scene from your movie. And then they watched those scenes. They flew everybody out to LA. They did like a big theater screening of all 10 shorts. And then they picked three people from that pool. And then you see these pitch meetings. So the final three people have pitch meetings with Ben Affleck, Matt Damon, Chris Moore, and then other Miramax people. And it's basically like, hey, I want to make this movie and here's why. And they talk about their reservations with the script and getting it made for $1 million and that kind of thing. A winner is chosen really quickly. I think it's like the end of episode two. But from that point on, you get to see the process of a first-time director going through everything it takes to make a movie. And it looks frustrating as hell. And this is why I want to show this, because we've gone through all the techniques and we've gone through, hey, you got to be creative. But now we're going to go through the studio system, and we're not talking a $20 million movie. We're talking a $1 million movie. And look, I have a corporate job. Like, my day job is a corporate job, and I am regularly frustrated by the decisions of other people, the penny pinching, the egos. And I'm sitting here watching Project Greenlight, and it's like, that's the same shit that I'm dealing with, but in the film world. But you get to see like those small victories that really get the director pumped up. You get to see the hardships of, holy shit, we don't have a lead actress, and we are coming up on a week out from where we're starting to shoot. We got people fired. There's just so much meat here to the filmmaking process. And then at the end of it all, you get to see the final film that comes from it, Stolen Summer. Now, I'll be honest with you, the movie itself, I don't think it's great, but for the purposes of seeing what making a film is like from beginning to end is incredibly valuable. Plus, you get to see how passionate people like Matt Damon are about making good movies, which is a bonus. I've always liked that guy, and in this show, he just comes off so well. It's just a person who wants to make good films. Now, here's the unfortunate thing. You can only see this on DVD. Mm-hmm. HBO, for some reason, you know, it's an HBO thing, but it's not streaming. I think seasons 3 and 4 are.
Oh, okay.
I bought a copy of this for $4 used to prepare for this show with you, and I ate it all up again. It includes both the series and the final film. So if you can find this set, I think it's well worth any film student or film hopeful to watch. And like I said, you can get it really, really cheap. So Stolen Summer, I would have the students read the script, watch the show, watch the movie. And I think it would probably weed some people out who said, you know what, I don't want to do this.
Oh, okay.
And then other people would probably get real excited about that prospect of fighting those battles and trying to win, setting your film in 1978 or filming your thing in Chicago, where, you know, other people might not.
Wow. You know, you got me thinking that, like, it would probably be to rework the entire list to do like things that are more behind the scenes, like more film documentaries maybe instead, where it's like, hey, yeah, Here's what it's like making a movie, here's how stressful it can get. Like El Mariachi, that's a good one too, because it's one where I think it's probably similar in a way where you're not really recommending just the movie. It's not just watching that movie. It's more the story, how it was made and everything. So
yeah,
actually, you know what? That kind of goes with my number one a little bit, because there is a documentary with it. So yeah.
All right. Well, we got some homework for your number one too.
Yeah. Well, number one for me, it's simple, and I've talked about it before, so it might be predictable, but King Kong.
Picture of all time.
Don't let him get me!
A beautiful girl torn from the arms of her lover by a jungle beast. King Kong.
See a battle between prehistoric monsters on an island time forgot.
A nightmare jungle creature from the primeval past stalking midnight streets.
My baby! It's got my baby!
See the thrill classic of all time, the biggest gorilla picture ever made in motion picture history, the jungle epic that can never be duplicated.
See RKO's original
King Kong.
King Kong.
King Kong.
The original Kong, and the documentary I was thinking of was I think it's on the Blu-ray. I know it was on one of the previous DVDs. There's a documentary all about the making of Kong. It's like multiple parts, kind of starts with the inception of it, and then it goes into like the shooting and the effects and everything. The effects were where I found it the most interesting, because it's really like the first major effects movie of its kind. I mean, there were things in the silent era, you know, there was, The Lost World, which Willis O'Brien did first. King Kong is like the first fully developed movie where it has sound, it has music, it has everything in it that makes what we now know today as a film. And like, how many movies do you watch now in the adventure or fantasy genre that are basically sort of a retelling of Kong? Where do we go with it? There's the visuals, there's the sound. Maybe just talking about the sound. This is new into the sound era. So like can you think of anything before 1933 where they had to invent all these different animal roars and stuff, like the T-Rex? What does the T-Rex sound like? Well, they did something with a lion. They played it backwards. They would record these animals in a zoo, and they'd play it backwards, slow it down, then layer it with something else. The documentary explains it more, but they had to invent all those sound effects. Then they had to fill it all with music. And it's not just like where the music just goes with the movie. It's like they do that Mickey Mousing effect where the music is like mimicking what's happening on screen in such a perfect way. And then the visuals, they just had to come up with all these things on the spot. There's front screen projection. There's rear screen projection. There's parts where like a part of the character is projected and then the other part is stop motion. They have live actors mixed with stop motion. Every shot is like a case by case basis. Like, how do you make this? And it's also the first movie, or at least the first movie you can think of, where the main character is a special effect. Like, you care about Kong more than anybody else. And then there's that like subplot, like a romance subplot between Anne and Jack Driscoll. And you see that same kind of subplot used in movies today of this type of genre. And then it also uses the Beauty and Beast trope, which is repeated so many times in cinema that it just becomes very familiar, and it works every time it's repeated. So I think it has all the fundamental aspects of movies, and it demonstrates fully what a movie could do, that it does something that you could never, ever see in real life. So that's why I picked King Kong.
King Kong, a great movie. Also, one of the first, I think it might have been the first ever movie to be released with a director's commentary, or it wasn't a director's commentary, but it was a commentary by film critics. And it's a really interesting commentary that outlines everything that you're talking about, the creative process and how they brought this movie to life. And you could tell how important it is because we just had a King Kong movie come out a couple months ago.
Yeah, yeah.
James, awesome list. We put together 9 films that anybody could be proud to put in front of film school students. Let's go ahead and recap our list for the listeners, and I will go first here. At number 5, I had Citizen Kane from 1941. At number 4, I had Silence of the Lambs from 91. At number 3, I had Die Hard, my favorite script ever, from 1988. At number 2, I had El Mariachi from 1992. And at number 1, I had Stolen Summer and the requisite Project Greenlight Season 1 from 2002.
Yeah. Yeah. So number 5, I had Citizen Kane. Number 4, I had Vertigo. Number 3, I had 2001. Number 2 was Wizard of Oz. And number 1 was Kong. I'm sure I got that all right. I think I recounted it all.
Indeed. Indeed. Yep. Now, we were talking about this before we got on air. There are plenty of movies that if you had more time, more spots on your list, you would put in. What are some of those honorable mentions, just real quick, that you felt bad leaving off your list?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's not like feature length, but Voyage to the Moon, like one of the first special effect movies. And then Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, like one of the first movies, like with like a totally, one of the first movies where there's a framing story where it's all told in flashback. And where there's a set design where everything looks like, where everything's not meant to imitate real life. Metropolis, which started so many tropes, sort of the inspiration for Blade Runner, and how it has like a dystopian world. Casablanca was one because it represents Hollywood in its prime. And The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, for all its, you know, wide shots and close-ups and the pacing of that movie. And then Jaws, like the first major blockbuster of its kind. So yeah, yeah, those are some of the honorable mentions.
All right. I'm actually surprised Jaws didn't make your list. I thought it was going to.
It almost did. Then I was thinking of 2001 and I was like, oh man, like it's hard.
It's a toss-up. They're both amazing movies.
Yeah, yeah.
I also had Casablanca on my honorable mentions. That was, if I wasn't going to go with Citizen Kane, I would have gone with Casablanca.
Yeah.
If you're into DVD commentaries, there's a really, really great one with Roger Ebert. He did one for Casablanca, and he talks about all the filmmaking techniques there. I think if you're into making movies or want to make movies, that's a great resource there.
Oh, is that the one where he says that every time, her name's Ingmar Bergman, every time she looks down, she's thinking of the past, and every time her eyes go up, she's into like the future. like something like that, like things you never think of.
Yeah, he was a really, really brilliant film analyst. He was a great film analyst. He just like studied film so much. That's why his reviews were so good.
Yeah.
In addition to Silence of the Lambs, I wanted to shout out a newer film that really gets suspense right, again with very little violence, but Uncut Gems from the Safdie brothers from 2019 is masterfully done.
Oh, I did see that, yeah.
The tension of the sound design, everybody talking over one another, it just puts you really on edge. Mm. Goodfellas is one that I think is technically amazing. I had to have Scorsese somewhere represented. I'm sad he didn't make my top five, but I'd like to see him, you know, get some love here. La La Land is a great one. You were talking color with Wizard of Oz. I think La La Land is a great job of color use.
Mm-hmm.
And then a couple low budget ones that could have taken that spot of El Mariachi, but I thought that one was more inspiring. Reservoir Dogs and then Kevin Smith's Clerks, of course.
Oh, yeah.
All from around the same time period. So,
uh-huh.
Yeah, that's those are my honorable mentions there.
Yeah.
James Rolfe. Amazing list. Thanks so much for joining us. We got to get some plugs in here. Where can people find more of your work, and where do you want to direct people to?
Go to Cinemassacre on YouTube. I think the actual URL I think is James Nintendo Nerd, but that's my YouTube channel.
I mean, look, just Google Angry Video Game Nerd and you're gonna find it
probably. but we should do this again sometime. It's fun putting these lists together.
Agreed. Thanks so much for coming on. I had a great time with this list. And if you're a film student, these are the 9 films you got to start with right here.
Yeah, there you go.
If you enjoyed this episode of Force 5, please let me know. You can do that for free by rating and reviewing the show on whatever app you're listening through. It does a lot for the show and lets me know that you like what I'm doing. And while you're at it, tell a friend, tell a family member, bug a coworker that loves movies. Just, again, annoy them until they listen or quit. To let me know what we missed or to send show feedback, you can email me at force5podcast@gmail.com or find me on Twitter @force5pod. Intro and outro bumpers come courtesy of Nate Spears. The top 5 list bumper was produced by me with music from Audio Binger. Until next time, stay safe, stay sane, and go watch some of our essential film school movies.